Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Welcome to the Interpreter Show, sponsored by Cruise Lady. Tonight, you've got me, Neil Rapley, here hosting the show, along with my lovely wife, Jasmine Rapley. And joining us by phone is Hales Swift. I hope that's you anyway, Hales.
That's at least who we think it is.
Fair enough.
To start off, we've had a few interesting things happen this week in the church. One noteworthy thing is a devotional by Brother and Sister Gay. This was a young adult worldwide broadcast. And from what I understand, unfortunately, I was not able to watch it as we were driving up the whole time and could not listen to it remotely. But the report, Sister Gay talked about seeing with spiritual eyes and ears so that we'll be able to navigate this life and that his spirit will be with all of his children. President Gay talked about how God's at the helm and we must trust him and that the Lord's calling us to save our lives and we can choose whether to live by covenant or convenience and that we must do all that we can to align our will with his because God has all power to save us. So beautiful messages from Brother and Sister Gay for young adults everywhere, especially during these trying times. I know it's easy to want to take convenient routes, especially now that we're doing home church. It might be easy to slacken in certain areas or want to be more casual in our observance, but I think President Gay's counsel is very apt that we need to make sure that regardless of how we're worshiping, that we are staying to our faith. Other news that was pretty exciting and sad, the church announced that it's canceling all pageants for 2020 and all youth treks. This is a pretty big announcement. I'm not exactly sure, but I believe it's unprecedented for the church to cancel all pageants worldwide and youth treks worldwide. This has caused a bit of a stir. In addition to canceling all treks and pageants for this summer, it has new counsel on ward and stake camps and youth conferences. As of right now, they're suspending all of those gatherings until further notice, with the caveat that later on in the summer, if, you know, things change, church leaders may choose to hold youth or stake gatherings, conferences within the church building, but to not do overnight anything.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, that is an interesting development in light of the fact that, at least in the U.S., a lot of states are beginning to loosen restrictions in regard to measures taken to slow or flatten the curve and spread of coronavirus. I think it's actually a good thing to see that even as we begin to ease out of some of this stuff, the church recognizes the importance of limiting and keeping large group activities nonetheless to a minimum in order to, we're still not in the clear here. It's important to continue to be judicious in getting large groups together.
Yeah, I think we'll see the church probably wait till we have a pretty clear indication that things are quite safe before you'll see them resume activities. I think part of that is because in the church we know how important and influential grandparents can be, and we aren't interested in having them become extinct.
Right. I don't know, because obviously I'm not, I don't work at the church, I don't speak for the church in any way, shape, or form, but I'd be really surprised if we saw any significant changes in the way things are the direction the church is going until things, like you said, seem to be in the clear, and I would suspect they're going to wait until things are pretty well in the clear globally. You're not going to see things. I may be wrong, but I would predict at least that you're probably not going to see them begin to have church meetings and things like that again in specific regions while other places cannot hold church. That's just my guess.
Yeah, so who knows how long we'll be doing home church and before we can get together for activities. I mean, I don't know. Maybe in Utah or in the United States, we might expect summer sometime we might be able to go back to church. I mean, I don't know. We're just guessing and shooting at the hip here, but I'm sure the leadership are just kind of taking it one day, one week at a time, and figuring things out. But that's pretty big news from the church about canceling pageants. Well, at least for the pageants, they're not canceling, but rather postponing. So the Hill Cumorah pageant will have one more year next year in 2021.
Right, right. Some may remember that actually pageants were canceled. Last year, they announced the discontinuation of pageants, and this year was supposed to be the last year that they were going to be holding them. But since things have gone the way they have, they are going to hold them one more year in 2021.
So what's actually happened is they've placed the Hill Cumorah pageant in suspended animation. It's almost like they've buried it in the hill to preserve it.
Yeah, you know, that is a very interesting way to look at it. I agree.
But after that, it's going right straight back to the angel, and anyway.
Indeed, and for Nauvoo, the Nauvoo pageant is still continuing on in coming years, and so for this year, they've decided to postpone 2020's pageant to next year, which means the same cast and family are going to be invited back for 2021 instead of this year. And I know that there's a young performing mission in Nauvoo that these performing missionaries come every summer and help with the Nauvoo pageant, but also do a bunch of musical and theatrical performances in Nauvoo every summer. And their mission has also been canceled for the summer. I don't know if they are being recalled for next year or not, but it'll be interesting to find out.
I don't know. That is interesting, though. In fact, for those of you who aren't familiar with what a young performing missionary is, I know I had never actually heard of it until just a few years ago, but apparently for the Nauvoo pageant, and I don't know if this was the case for other pageants, I feel like it wasn't, but they actually call missionaries, they call people on a mission to do to perform in the Nauvoo pageant, and it's usually a 12-week mission or something like that.
Well, it depends. If you're a young performing missionary, that's a different kind of call where you're serving for about 12 weeks throughout the entire summer doing the pageant. You're part of what they would call like the dance corps. You're doing the more acrobatic dance moves on stage and some of the more intense theatrical things that some of the other volunteer families might not be up to.
Right.
And then in addition, you'll do programs in the evening, such as Sunset on the Mississippi, where you sing songs about, you know, the saints in Nauvoo, or they have another theatrical performance in the morning and in the afternoon, or they'll sing songs throughout Nauvoo while tourists are going walking the streets. You've got these minstrels playing and singing songs of the older days, which is quite charming and beautiful. But I do also believe that if you are participating in the specifically just the Nauvoo pageant, there also is a certain like volunteer missionary call that's issued, at least for the core performers. And then there's families that also can volunteer and apply to be families involved in these pageants. And I'm not exactly sure if they're called specifically as missionaries or not for that time. And I don't know how it works for Cumorah either. I'm really only familiar with Nauvoo.
I had a friend who volunteered at, you know, who was in the Cumorah pageant, just probably 12 years ago or so now, 13 years ago maybe. I can't remember if she was. I don't think she was a missionary though. She was just kind of. It was something she wanted to do. So I don't know if they had missionaries and also volunteers.
Well, I for one am.
It's interesting.
Okay. Oh, go ahead, Hales.
Go ahead, Jasmine. I can make a comment in a minute.
I, for one, am sad to see pageants go. I certainly understand where the brethren are coming from and sustain them in that decision. There's bigger fish to fry, as they might say, but I'll certainly miss the pageants. I think it's a beautiful memento. It's a time capsule of a certain era of Latter-day Saint history to go see, like, the Manti pageant or the Hill Cumorah pageant, where you have this recorded dialogue from the 1970s, 60s sometimes, and very old music. And it's for a modern audience, it can feel a little stilted and strange, but it's fascinating to me to take a look into 1960s Mormonism and kind of see how they viewed the Book of Mormon, how they viewed the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the settling of Utah, the translation of the Book of Mormon. It's I find it beautiful and a touching tribute to that, to the testimony of those people who put the original pageants together. And I'm happy the Nauvoo pageant is still continuing on, because that one is quite the gem. And I believe the Mesa pageant's also continuing, which I've never personally attended, but have heard that it is one of the best. It is, you know, theatrical and moving and touching and about the Savior. Hales, have you seen any of the Latter-day Saint pageants?
So I swung down to Manti the most recent year I was in Utah, and that was fun. I don't know if it was the last or the second to the last year for that, but we were a little bit late, so I only saw the end of it, unfortunately. But it was what I thought was fun, and we talked to the people afterwards. That was enjoyable, too. It's interesting, there have been a variety of different missions that have existed in the church. Obviously, the most common is someone being called for a period of time to preach the gospel, a proselyting mission. But there have also been the performing arts missions that you mentioned. There have also been fine arts missions in which people were called on a mission to go learn to paint really well in France, and then come back and paint the murals for the Salt Lake Temple. So, I don't know. I personally find the larger concept of missions fascinating, because they can be a great variety of different things. And I think in some ways that's a really great concept, because we can each be anxiously engaged in building up the kingdom of God, using whatever set of talents the Lord happens to have given us. And it's not all just proselyting, though proselyting is great and a wonderful experience for those who have that opportunity. And I'm grateful for the opportunity I had to do that.
You know, that really is an excellent point.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. You finish your thought.
Sorry, I have a dreadful habit of pausing. Suffice it to say, there's room in God's choir for all of us critters.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really important point, that missionaries don't just come in one size or one shape, and that different kinds of missions are suitable for different people. I know, for example, in church history, like you mentioned, there were artistic missions to learn how to better serve and build the kingdom of God for the temple. Brigham Young University's Religious Studies Center is just about to release a new book called Storming the Nation, The Unknown Contributions of Joseph Smith's Political Missionary. And this is a book about the men and women who were called as missionaries to essentially help campaign for Joseph Smith's presidential campaign. So an unknown part of church history and not very appreciated, but back in the early days of the church, missions came in a lot of different sizes and shapes. And today we see similar things. For example, the church is emphasizing service missions as a much more viable option in addition to proselyting mission. And I think that's becoming even more prescient as COVID-19 has restricted proselyting missions to just your native country for right now. And the church
and the
is changing very quickly how they're calling missionaries, when they're calling, and how they're doing training, and how they're going out in the field or just staying home. And so it's becoming really challenging to proselyte right now. But the missionaries and members of the church can find ways to serve in all sorts of ways, such as doing service missionaries. And I know Neil and I, at Book of Mormon Central, we've been experiencing this a little bit more. We've just started receiving service missionaries from the church to help us build the kingdom in our way. And these missionaries aren't doing things that they may have expected when they first signed up to serve a mission, because instead of knocking doors, they're editing videos and going through articles and books and answering emails for our app. But all of those contributions matter, and they can be just as satisfying and just as spiritually fulfilling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that... it's a great way to help people, young people, utilize the talents that they have, rather than kind of just be expected to fit into a particular box and go out and knock doors and proselyte and so on and so forth. For some of these kids, they don't feel comfortable doing that, or for whatever reason, they've opted not to do that kind of thing, but they have wonderful talents, like video editing and things like that, and can bless the kingdom in so many ways, and it gives them opportunities to utilize those talents in ways that will help spread the gospel.
Yeah, and I know I've had sisters, I had one sister serve a proselyting mission, and she enjoyed that, but had challenges in some ways or others. I had another sister serve a young performing mission in Nauvoo, and found that an incredible life-changing experience. And Neil and I have a friend whose patriarchal blessing specifically told him that he would not serve a regular mission. And while that was really hard for him to accept at the time, eventually he was called as a young performing missionary to Nauvoo, which is just, you know, a four-month mission. And so it was not conventional, but was transformative for him. And he was able to bless hundreds of people's lives that come through Nauvoo every single year. So you never know how you can bless people. On the topic of pageants and trek, I'd be interested to get some of your guys' thoughts on the practice of trek in general. I know for those growing up in Utah, it's very beloved ritual for youth to participate in this reenactment of the pioneers traveling from Illinois to Utah, and they'll usually do it by having a 2 or 3 day youth conference where they reenact and dress up as pioneers. And I grew up in Connecticut, and we did the same thing, but it certainly wasn't similar to the pioneers' experience at all, because we were hauling handcarts over boulders in the Appalachian Mountains, not exactly across the plains. And youth across the nation and world are doing them in their own scenarios, but I found it personally a really fulfilling experience and loved my time. However, since the church came out with their news release, I've seen a lot of members of the church express their own opinions about their experience with trek and how it was difficult or hard for them to understand, or how they hope that the church does away with it entirely. So I'd be interested in just getting your guys' thoughts on, did you enjoy trek? Do you find it a useful practice in the church to do to recreate that experience, or do you think there's ways to improve it?
I think that, first of all, just for my own experience, you know, we did trek, and I was, I don't know, maybe 16 or 17 when we did it. And we went up by Martin's Cove, and we actually traveled a part of the trail and crossed a river and all, you know, all of that. My experience personally was very positive. I enjoyed it. I had some very spiritual experiences and a moving, you know, we had a moving testimony meeting and all of that. And I think, personally, that there is a lot of value in reenactment of the past and of trial and hardship in particular. And trek has kind of been controversial in some corners of what I'll just call online Mormonism, for lack of a better word. I know we're not supposed to use that word so much anymore, but for lack of a better term, in online Mormonism, it's been somewhat controversial, and this recent announcement has kind of brought that controversy to the surface amongst some audiences and some groups of people, largely those who have not liked them in the first place. And I understand where some people are coming from when they talk about I understand why maybe some people have bad experiences, and it's kind of there's a little bit of a chance factor that goes into this. That on some level, it depends on how local leaders implement and practice doing the trek. And you know, there are some there are what I'll just call horror stories that I've heard, and actually a couple of members of my own family. Both my older brother and my older sister, when they went on trek, had some pretty scary accidents and things like that. Though I won't presume to speak for them, but I've never heard them speak negatively about the experience, despite those incidents. But there are a lot of horror stories, and some of them stem from what I would say some fairly extreme measures taken by local leaders sometimes to really try and replicate the experience by going a little over the top.
With, like, low food rations.
Yeah, low.
And pushing you really hard physically on the trail.
Yeah, exactly.
Just get a roll for dinner.
And my,
only half
my
pound of flour a day.
Yeah, my own experience, as I remember it at least, and perhaps some people who are in my trek group might hear this and think, oh man, he is not remembering this right at all. But as I recall, we didn't have some of those kind of things. The first night we had a very nice, very full kind of Dutch oven dinner. You know, we were
we
living
had pretty cushy.
Yeah, I didn't experience things like that. I understand where some people are coming from, and for some people, what I find sad though is people who either are converts to the church, or maybe they didn't grow up in the U.S. or whatever the case may be, and so they feel like, well, my ancestors, they didn't go across the plains, they didn't participate in this trek, and so they don't feel like they connect to it as part of their own heritage. That makes me sad because I feel like this is not really supposed to be, or isn't, it's not strictly a part of the heritage of those who descend from the pioneers.
Mm-hmm.
When you become a Latter-day Saint, you become a part of this community, and this should at least become part of your own heritage. These people, they made these tremendous sacrifices in part to benefit you. You are reaping the benefits of what they endured and the hardship and the trial they went through. By having the church available today and the gospel available today, which is largely thanks to what they did. And so it makes me sad when people do not identify with the pioneers as part of their personal heritage, despite the fact that, I feel like that's something people should be able to connect with, whether they are in the United States or not, whether they are converts to the church or not, or whether they have, you know, actual pioneer ancestors.
And I think it's also a deeply ironic decision, if you will, because those converts who come into the faith are very much the harvest of the faith, or of the acts of faith that were planted through all of this gathering that took place.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely.
So it's not just that the experience of the pioneers is a common treasure to the church, which it is, but it also so much laid the foundation for the opportunities that others have had to receive the gospel, that they're very much a direct consequence.
Mm-hmm.
So to fail to embrace that is ironic, at least. Anyway, continue your thought.
Right. I agree. And just to jump into Kumfungi a little bit, in Alma 5, he says, "Have you sufficiently remembered the captivity of your fathers?" And it's this idea of remembering those who have come before you, remembering the sacrifice, remembering the faith and the consecration. And if you remember that and at what cost you have the blessings that you have today, it can help you appreciate that a little bit better. This is an interesting angle that had caused me to pause this week as I was thinking about it. So the Sistas in Zion account, they're on Instagram and Facebook. They're two Black Latter-day Saints who have a fun social media personality online. And this week, Zandra, one of the sisters, was venting about Trek and how she was glad they were canceled because she can't stand Trek. And she was explaining why. And then she kind of backtracked a little bit and like, no, I didn't mean to offend anyone. Let me explain a little more. And she provided an interesting perspective that I hadn't considered before. And I'm willing to accommodate in my worldview. She talked about how it's hard for her to understand Trek because of the racial tensions there. When she talks about how, like, you know, when all my white blonde friends dress up in pioneer clothes, they look like cute little pioneers. When I do, I look like a runaway slave. And how that can create a very, I don't know, not hurtful, but a tense dynamic for her in her mind. Not that the rest of the people in her group were considering her the runaway slave by any means, but she was considering how, you know, my parents, when I grew up, they took me to plantations to learn about slavery. They would take us to museums, and we learned all about this stuff. But we never reenacted slavery. We never had a slave master come and whip us for being disobedient and starve us half to death. You know, she expressed that that's trauma that we don't think that's unnecessary and cruel to reinflict because we've learned from our mistakes, sort of thing. And how so Trek is hard for her to understand because we're deliberately inflicting pain on some people. You know, now the men are going to the Mormon battalion, so all the men have to step aside while the women pull these handcarts by themselves, or you only have a roll for dinner tonight. And she saw that as she just couldn't understand it, like why people would want to do that. And she got a lot of feedback on that post. However, then today, I just recently saw that she posted again saying, thanks for all of your feedback. It's been really interesting to consider your guys' point of view. And I can understand how Trek can be meaningful because it's not about just inflicting pain or inflicting trauma and inflicting abuse on people like you would in slavery. It's to demonstrate the sacrifice because the pioneers chose this. They chose to go serve in the Mormon battalion, and the women chose to continue on faithful. You know, they chose to travel to Utah even though they knew it would be rough. And she kind of, you know, backpedaled a little bit in reframing her objections to Trek. But I just thought that was a really interesting discussion that she inspired on social media, and also for me to think about how racial tensions might play into how you view Mormon Trek and how you might appreciate it better or how it might be difficult for you. So those are just some thoughts I've been having.
And
for me,
I think that is... go ahead, Hales.
I was going to say, for me, the key to enjoying Trek is to avoid the odd-numbered ones like a plague. If you stick to 2, 4, and 6, those are about all the Trek you need, and maybe Next Generation and Deep Space Nine.
You lost me for a second.
Star Trek. For those who haven't picked up yet, he's talking about Star Trek.
And that's true. The even number ones are the safe Star Trek.
The odd ones, you might say they have somewhat of an uneven reputation.
I think, though, the Sisters in Zion post is particularly interesting. And like I said, I am sympathetic. I understand where some people are coming from, especially those who have bad experiences, and whether that's coming from overzealous leaders pushing them to do too much or you know, freak accidents or even racial tensions and things like that. But it does, I think, bring to the forefront something that I think is important to remember, is that, you know, there we might think of... pioneers as and we maybe tend to visualize pioneers as white, but there were there were actually free African Americans who had joined the church and came across the plains and were pioneers, and there's maybe that's a problem, that's a cultural problem, if we think white people dressed up in pioneer clothes look like pioneers, but Black people dressed up in pioneer clothes don't look like pioneers, if maybe that makes sense. I don't know.
Yeah. And I've personally gained appreciation for pioneers through even my father. My father's from Argentina, and so he would not look like a runaway slave, but he also wouldn't look like a pioneer necessarily when dressed up that way. But since he joined the church... He also has gained an appreciation, and he took us with my mom and my family. We went on a couple church history trips here and there. Of course, we lived back east, so one year we went to Palmyra, and one year we went to Nauvoo, and even he was able to bear testimony and express to us how much he appreciated the sacrifice of our forebears. And, you know, that's how he adopts them as his heritage as well, even though he was born completely outside of the faith and the culture. And it's very much like adopting into the house of Israel. When we are baptized and we take upon us the covenant and the gospel of Jesus Christ, we become part of the house of Israel symbolically and literally. And I think the same has become true in Mormonism with pioneers. We adopt, we become adopted into the pioneer legacy when we accept the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Right. And one thing I do think your dad can appreciate about the pioneer ethos or mythos or whatever you want to call it is, I mean, he knows what it's like to just leave everything you know behind and to go somewhere new with very little to no personal possessions and have to try and start and build a new life. And
and he did that in a lot, in part because of the gospel. He immigrated from Argentina to the United States in 1982 or 4, I don't remember which, but pretty much left almost everything he had behind, ended up losing his luggage, and so then very much had nothing. Ooh. and couldn't speak the language very well, but they immigrated because his sister had gotten married to someone who was going to go practice medicine in America. And when they decided to move to America, and they had all joined the church, or at least his sister and his mother had joined the church, they said, well, we're going to keep the family together. You know, we have the gospel in our lives, and we want to make sure that our family stays intact. And so they immigrated, and they lost everything, and it was a long road to establishing themselves in a new country and in a new culture of the gospel, because the gospel is the same everywhere you go, but also very, very different when you, depending on what country you're in. So that was a pioneering journey for him. And so that's my family's legacy. And we very much draw on that story of faith and sacrifice and pioneering, if you will. But in addition, we still incorporate the pioneer legacy of the 19th century Latter-day Saint.
Right. I think maybe with that, we will move on to the next topic. But before we do, just a quick word from our sponsor. The Interpreter Radio Show is sponsored by Cruise Lady, Latter-day Saint Adventures. Explore the world with a Latter-day Saint scholar. Join supporters of the Interpreter Foundation on the Ultimate Egypt Tour with Egyptologist John Gee and Professor Daniel Peterson on November 20th this year. See the best of Egypt, the pyramids of Giza, the temples of Luxor and Karnak, the Valley of the Kings, and the magnificent Temple of Ramses II at Abu Simbel. Space is limited, so call Cruise Lady at 801-453-9494 or find more information at cruiselady.com. That's 801-453-9494 or on the web at cruiselady.com. With that said, there's actually two kind of announcements relative to the Interpreter Foundation that I think are worth mentioning here, two events that are coming up here, sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation. And one was supposed to actually take place this weekend, but due to the complications created by the coronavirus outbreak, has been postponed to September 18th and 19th of this year. It is the it's a conference titled Tracing Ancient Threads in the Book of Moses, and it's primarily sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation, but it also has co-sponsors from the co-sponsorship from the BYU Department of Ancient Scripture, Book of Mormon Central, and also Fair Mormon. It's got a really, I don't think we have a list of presentations available for that, but there is a list of speakers. And so it's got a really kind of a great who's who list of speakers here. Matthew Bowen, who's a BYU professor, or a BYU Hawaii professor, who has been doing excellent work on names in the Book of Mormon and also in the Book of Moses, and wordplay off of those names, in fact. And then Jeffrey Bradshaw, who is, like, you know, when you say Book of Moses, Jeff Bradshaw is the go-to guy on almost all things Book of Moses. He's been doing stuff on it for a long time and has so many great insights. David Calabro, another great scholar, Terrell Givens, Jeff Lindsay, Jared Ludlow, Noel Reynolds, and John W. Welch.
So, that's quite the lineup.
Yeah, it's a really impressive group. And keynoting, I guess. Well, the the only speakers for Friday night are Elder Bruce T. Hafen and Sister Marie K. Hafen, the Emeritus General Doherty brother, Elder Hafen.
But they are wonderful. They spoke at the Fair Mormon Conference last year and have great testimony of staying true to the faith and faith crises, dealing with questions and doubts. They're awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. So mark that on your calendars. September 18th and September 19th of this year is when that is scheduled for. It's sure to be a really, really exciting event. Going along with that, if you don't want to wait until then to start getting some great insights into the Book of Moses, this week, just starting this last week, let's see if we have a publication date on
May 1st.
May 1st. So just a couple days ago, this last, what was that, Friday? The Pearl of Great Price Central, which is, of course, sponsored by Book of Mormon Central, just started posting in Book of Moses Insights. And Jeff Bradshaw is heavily involved in that. And, in fact, those are being cross-posted onto the Interpreter Foundation website as well. And, yeah, the first insight went up on May 1st. It's on Enoch's Prophetic Commission, specifically tied to Moses 6:26 through 36. And goes over questions about its similarity to New Testament passages and language, and whether this is simply a borrowing from the New Testament or whether there's really something substantive and ancient here.
So with prophets in the ancient Near East, they often follow a similar prophetic call pattern. And Jeff Bradshaw points out that they typically fall into two categories. One is either the narrative call pattern, where the prophet's called by a conversation with the Lord, and they kind of go back and forth about the prophet's objections to his fitness for the mission, and then they're eventually resolved. And then the second type is a throne theophany call pattern, where the prophet ascends to the presence of God and receives his divine commission through this glorious vision. And he talks about how while Moses and Jeremiah and Enoch probably fit the first pattern, and the call of Enoch we don't get in the Bible, but we get it in the Book of Moses. And so it's significant that the call of Enoch, as we have it in the Book of Moses, fits perfectly the call pattern that we find in the Hebrew Bible for both Moses and Jeremiah. It fits really well in an ancient world for this type of literature. And then, as Neil mentioned, he also goes on to talk about intertextuality with the Book of John, how specifically the baptism of Jesus, where it talks about the Spirit descending from heaven like a dove, and a voice from heaven saying, "This is my beloved Son." You get echoes of that coming in the Book of Moses in chapter 6. And so Jeff Bradshaw goes through and talks about what their relationship might be and how we can approach this and reconcile it, and how the Book of Enoch or the Book of Moses comes out really well when it comes to evidence of its authenticity and its ancient feel. Really cool stuff.
Absolutely. And again, if you want to look that up for yourself, that's available at the pearlofgreatpricecentral.org. And it's also at the Interpreter Foundation website, interpreterfoundation.org as well. That's just the first of what is going to end up being many insights into the Book of Moses that will be published in the coming weeks, leading up to this this conference that will be held in the fall. So lots of exciting stuff on the Pearl of Great Price, and specifically on the Book of Moses, coming out right now. Definitely check that out if that is something that piques your interest. The other announcement that came from the Interpreter Foundation this week, this came on this last, let's see, was it Thursday, April 30th, is Interpreter Foundation issued a call for papers for their Temple on Mount Zion conference. And I'll just read from the call for papers here really quick. The biennial Temple on Mount Zion conference will be held on Saturday, November 7th, 2020, at Brigham Young University. This conference has been a forum for Latter-day Saint scholars to deal with the ancient temple in light of the most up-to-date scholarship from the perspective of faith and commitment to the principles of the Restoration. We would like to invite individuals interested in contributing to the discussion of ancient temples to submit a proposal with a title, thesis statement,
and brief outline to Stephen Ricks and Jeffrey M. Bradshaw. And their emails are provided in the announcement here. I won't read them aloud, though. From these submissions, we will select individuals whom we will invite to present at the conference. Please be aware that the presentation proposals should deal with the ancient temple and avoid any explicit reference to the modern Latter-day Saint temple. Papers collected for the conference will need to be submitted by the presenters in advance of the conference.
A really exciting conference. I have always loved the Temple on Mount Zion conference, which always gets published as a book later on after the proceedings get wrapped up. And it's fascinating stuff. And as Neil mentioned, the proposals in the papers are going to be dealing with the ancient temple and avoiding references to the modern LDS temple. However, you often can find fascinating insights into your modern Latter-day Saint worship for those who have ears to hear, as they might say. In order to reverence the sanctity of the temple, we don't talk about it, but they're dealing with motifs of the ancient world that we find in our Latter-day Saint temple, and that can really enrich your temple worship if you ever wanted to know the symbolism behind things, the meaning behind why we do things in a certain order or gestures.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you really want to get a flavor for what these conferences are like, they have YouTube videos. The Interpreter Foundation YouTube channel has the videos of from past conference presentations for the Temple on Mount Zion, so you can listen to those. And as Jasmine mentioned, all of the previous conferences have been published in book form as well, and there's just a lot of gems, a lot of treasures in there. They tie in ancient temple stuff in from the Old Testament, New Testament, in the Book of Mormon, of course, and also Book of Abraham, Book of Moses. They do a really great job illustrating how the temple really does permeate all of Scripture in some fascinating and really compelling ways.
Yeah, they'll talk about things like the importance of and the meaning of names or specific gestures, or dealing with creation and the Garden of Eden narratives and how they played into the ancient temple. And just to give you a sense of some of the past presentations, Stephen Smoot talked about the symbolism of the cupped hand in ancient Egypt and ancient Israel. John Gee also talked about the symbolism of taking the shoes off of your feet. And Jeff Bradshaw in another year talked about what Joseph Smith could have known about the LDS endowment back in 1836. Usually we think of the endowment as we know it being established in 1842, but Jeff Bradshaw a couple years ago presented a paper of his evidence for inklings that Joseph Smith had in way back in the Kirtland era period, 1836, for the Latter-day Saint endowment. And Carly Anderson has presented before on coronation motifs and enthroning the daughter of Zion with robes of righteousness and with the coronation theme. And David Calabro has presented on ritual gestures and signs to indicate certain procedures of ceremony and covenant-making signs. So really, really cool stuff. And definitely, you could spend hours and days plumbing the depths of these papers for cool insights in your temple worship.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so that call of papers is, again, available if you want to read it for yourself at the Interpreter Foundation website, interpreterfoundation.org. If you're interested in submitting, that'll have the information. But I imagine for most people, this is another save the date. November 7th, 2020 is what you'll want to mark on your calendars. That is the day they are currently planning for hosting.
And of course, you know, with COVID-19, everything's always a little bit tentative, but we hopefully will be back in swing for having events in November, because I am really excited to do something like the Temple on Mount Zion conference. If I believe I'm correct, it's no registration and it's completely free. So this isn't a pitch to give the Interpreter Foundation money. This is a service to the public.
Right, absolutely.
So that's also a fine idea as it goes.
Yeah. It is a fine idea to give the Interpreter Foundation money if that's what you want to do.
Right, please donate.
I know Dan Peterson, the chairman, would appreciate anything you can offer. But the fact that it's free goes also for the Book of Moses conference that we were mentioning earlier as well. And that is one of the great things about what the Interpreter Foundation does is they host these conferences and they have always made it a point to make admission free. So they're trying to get this information out and make it available to the public in every way they can. While we're speaking about events, we may as well mention the Fair Mormon Conference as well. Will be coming up in August. They will not be holding a physical conference, but they will be doing the conference virtually. And I don't know, exact details may be coming out in the coming weeks and months, but it is worth, again, just having that on your radar if this is the kind of thing you are interested in. I know they are still discussing and deciding on who speakers are going to be and those kinds of logistics. But the Fair Mormon Conference has always been a highlight for me, always worth attending, even if only virtually. There's always just some great insights there.
So this week, the Interpreter Foundation published a new paper, and this one's by Craig L. Foster. And his paper is entitled Death to Seducers, Examples of Latter-day Saint-Led Extra-Legal Justice in Historical Context. And while that's kind of a jumble of jargon, he is essentially, if I understand correctly, exploring Latter-day Saints that did illegal things and putting them in extra legal things and putting them in context of what was accepted or legally permissible in the 19th century.
Yes, and
so these would be Latter-day Saint vigilantes, right?
to an extent, yes. I mean, that's that verbiage is not is carefully chosen, and illegal versus extra legal. There's a reason scholars use a term like extra legal, and it's because these things, while maybe technically illegal, were the world operated
widely recognized as things that society did.
Yeah, yeah. Especially out on the western frontier of the United States, which, trust me, Utah in the in pretty much all of the 19th century was frontier, territory. Things were just done a little different, and law enforcement was not as, shall we say, vigilant, or even as readily accessible as might be preferable, and so there was a tendency to take law into one's own hands, right? And so, that's where this notion of extra legal justice kind of comes from, a lot of this kind of stuff, it can come across as very lurid and scandalizing to our modern ears. And so this is why Craig here is trying to put some of this in historical context to help us understand this is part and parcel of the world that the saints lived in at this time.
And so examples of what he's talking about might be cases of castration by Latter-day Saints in the early years of Utah. Latter-day Saints castrating people for sexual indiscretion. And so he goes through the cases there and talks about pulling aside all of the exaggeration that's gone into telling these stories, and then also contextualizing what was going on in the 19th century and how can we make sense of this situation, and also the violent rhetoric, talking about people who committed sexual sins, talking big about stoning, punishing, doing things to discipline people who broke God's law or the government's law. And so then he also goes through and strips back exaggeration that's been told about these stories, and then contextualizes how this would have been done in the 19th century. And how it was a lot more common to speak in more brash terms of government punishment, you might say.
Well, sure. So, for example, Saints talks about some of the harsh rhetoric during the Reformation period, and then how, if I recall correctly, a particular fellow who had committed a sin offered to offered to face some of these harsh punishments in order to kind of make up for his sin. And Brigham Young's response was, tell him to go and sin no more. It's like, no, we're not going to do any of this stuff to him.
Right.
It's almost designed to explain to someone the spiritual gravity of what they're doing more than to have anything to do with a temporal reality as such. And the point is, repent.
Right, and I really like that way of putting it, that they're trying to stress the seriousness of what they're doing for the eternal consequences and the eternal their spiritual consequences. And often the way that's done is through very physical terms, if you will.
Well, today we make a covenant, and we want to emphasize the severity and sanctity of those covenants, and want to stress that there are consequences for not obeying, but we do those more in spiritual rather than physical terms. And in the ancient world, when you would make a covenant, you would cut an animal. You would dismember or slice in half or sacrifice an animal to basically say, if I don't fulfill my part of the covenant, may I be as this animal. It was to emphasize how serious this is, even if they wouldn't actually cut themselves in half if they broke their covenant. But
it's an implicit simile curse,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Right.
Absolutely. And so I really like that point you made about how it's emphasizing the spiritual weight, not necessarily acting out in literal physical terms. In all.
And it makes sense, right? Because we talk about spiritual death, right? And we know that the spirit can't die. What spiritual death means is that the person becomes separated from God on a long-term basis. And this happens because of sin. So, logically speaking, the metaphorical consequence of sin is death. And Paul says these sorts of things all the time. So it's not a surprise that you'd see similar rhetoric come up among the Latter-day Saints, but sometimes portrayed in an overly literal way.
Right.
To work upon the minds of people.
It reminds me of the elementary school adage, cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. You know, that's what you do when you make a promise with your best friend in elementary school. And you do it flippantly. I mean, it's just like a silly thing you do, saying, you know, I'm really serious about keeping my promise, cross my heart, hope to die. But
did you never stuck needles in your eye after breaking a promise?
But clearly, it's more of a metaphorical way to emphasize that I'm taking this pinky promise very seriously. Even if you wouldn't act out the literal implications of the promise.
And you just hope the children aren't feeling overly literal-minded that day.
Right. But this is a really good paper you should check out. And he goes through and talks about how in the 19th century, this also was a lot more common than it is today to talk about things in violent terms, even if you're not going to act them out.
Well, yeah, and in fact, the acting out of violence was a lot more common, too.
Such as the shooting, tarring and feathering, or whipping of adulterers, for example.
Right, and I mean, we see this, it's certainly part of Latter-day Saint history. Not only, Latter-day Saints are certainly on the receiving end of this kind of extra-legal vigilante justice, the tarring and feathering of Joseph Smith and other leaders, the destruction of Hans Mill, and these kinds of things are all part of that kind of stuff being perpetuated against Latter-day Saints, and a lot of the mobs and stuff that were doing this kind of stuff, in their minds it was justified because for various reasons, and we could go over each of those in their own context if we wanted to, but we do not have time. Also, I mean, if you imagine whatever the last movie you saw on the Wild Wild West, right, and this Wild Wild West mythos that we have, while I don't want to give credence to the idea that everything Hollywood portrays in history is always accurate, I do just want to say that this notion of the Wild West is not a myth. Things were very, very wild on the Western frontier, and there was a lot of violence. There was a lot of taking justice into your own hands. There was a lot of, sheriffs were usually not even upstanding citizens. They were just, you know, the guy that was out there in this little western town that needed a job, and so he was made the sheriff, and he would bend the law in order to enforce the law and things like that, to bring ruffians in line, and, you know, you lose at gambling, and so you shoot the guy you lost to because you don't want to pay or you can't pay. I mean, that kind of stuff is happening, and it's happening in Utah. It's happening in Utah amongst the Gentiles, if you will, out in Frogtown or Fairfield. And it's happening in other places out in the Western frontier all over the place. And so this is just, it's a really different world than what we're accustomed to living in. And the saints were trying to make it in that world, you know?
And it certainly isn't to condone or applaud behavior such as tarring and feathering, whipping, shooting, any extra legal behavior that we would consider unethical today, but rather to put in context and to recognize and acknowledge that this happened a lot more often back then, and it was more morally and societally acceptable, but also to know that members of the church in church history and today are human and aren't always perfect and are making the best moral judgments to their ability, don't always get it right, but the church is still true. And the foundations of the restoration, of the translation of the Book of Mormon, the establishment of the priesthood, the leadership and succession under Brigham Young, all were true parts of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so even when people in the church history make mistakes or do bad things according to our modern eyes, it's okay because the church is still true. And everything falls into place when that's the keystone of your religion.
Right. And honestly, if you are inclined to judge this kind of behavior, don't be so sure that if you had lived in this time, you wouldn't have participated in it or wouldn't have at least seen it as acceptable, because it's hard to recognize how much of our own moral compass is actually shaped by the world we live in.
It's very true. I mean, just look at what happens when laws change.
Oh, yeah.
Suddenly the opprobrium of being something being against the law goes away, and people are like, oh, it's fine. Whereas before they were like, oh, it's terrible.
Oh,
when
yeah,
really the thing itself hasn't changed in any particular way.
Absolutely, and that kind of thing can go both ways, right? Things that were previously legal, but then become illegal. Suddenly, there's a mental
shift. Like gathering public.
Yeah, the public has there's a societal shift in perception of the acceptableness of that behavior.
And not to use a very controversial issue, but because it's just accelerated so much in my very short lifetime, the idea of LGBTQ issues, think about how society or even you think about gay marriage today and what you thought of it even 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Within your lifetimes, we've seen the shift of how society views morality on this one issue. And so it's not hard to see how in the 19th century they could have seen different forms of extra-legal behavior or not. If you want to learn more about this topic or Craig Foster's other works, he has a lot of interesting stuff. He also did a paper on polygamy and Joseph Smith's very young marriages and how he contextualizes that in the 19th century as well. Turns out in the 19th century, while it was not terribly common, it did happen, and he has several dozen attested cases, and if not more, of young 16, 15, 14-year-old girls marrying at young ages, mostly on frontiers, which Illinois would have been at that time. And so Craig Foster's done great work on polygamy and has clearly shown that he also does great work with this with the Utah history of extra-legal affairs.
Well, he's done some additional stuff on Mountain Meadows Matter.
Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Intro reminded you, this is The Interpreter Show. I am Neil Rapley. I'm joined here in studio by Jasmine Rapley, and Ailes Swift is here on the line with us. We were just wrapping up on talking about the most recent interpreter paper by Craig Foster and some of the additional work he's done as I was mentioning, he's done some other stuff on Mountain Meadows and the culture of violence in early Utah and the like. And so this is kind of right in his wheelhouse. We are now in the second hour, and so we're going to be transferring over to our Come Follow Me discussion here in just a moment. Before we do that, I would just like to plug in another word from our sponsor real quick here. The Interpreter Radio Show is sponsored by Cruise Lady, Latter-day Adventures. Explore the world with a Latter-day Saint scholar. Join supporters of the Interpreter Foundation on the Ultimate Egypt Tour with Egyptologist John Gee and Professor Daniel Peterson on November 20th this year. See the best of Egypt, the pyramids of Giza, the temples of Luxor and Karnak, the Valley of the Kings, and the magnificent Temple of Ramses II at Abu Simbel. Space is limited, so call Cruise Lady at 801-453-9444 or find more information at cruiselady.com. That's 801-453-9444 or on the web at cruiselady.com. All right, so with that said, we are ready to dive into our Come Follow Me roundtable here. This week we are covering Alma 5 through 7. An exciting part of the, well, I don't know, exciting in for some people.
A very beautiful part of the
book. A very beautiful part, absolutely.
And it's pretty refreshing to only have three chapters instead of trying to marathon through a bunch. We can really dig deep and have a great discussion. Few chapters.
Well, you say three chapters, but Alma 5 is lengthy, over, I think it's 62 verses.
Yeah,
it's big.
Yeah, so just for some quick context, some quick background here, this is Alma the Younger, and he has been serving as the chief judge for, let's see, what years? Is this the ninth year of the reign of the judges? Is this
eight?
That's around the eighth or ninth year. It should say in chapter 4, but I don't have that right in front of me. But towards the end.
Oh, the seventh year. Yes, the ninth year of the reign of the judges, Alma goes to Zarahemla.
Okay. So this is the ninth year of the reign of the judges. Alma's been serving as the chief judge, but he's also been the high priest over the church. And he's wanting to, he's recognizing some trends, if you will, that are disturbing to him as the high priest. And he feels like his role as chief judge is defining him from fulfilling his important duties to get out there and preach to the people. So he actually relinquishes the judgment, gives it to a man named Baiha, if I'm not mistaken, and appoints him in his place. And then he goes to begin a circuit of preaching, if you will. Well, circuit's a very 19th century Methodist way of putting it, but he's going to go on a tour. He's going to go preaching in a couple places, and his starting point is Zarahemla, and that's what we get in Alma 5, is his very lengthy discourse that he gives to the saints or to the members of the church in Zarahemla. Not very pleased with them. There's a lot of problems with the church in Zarahemla at this time. That's probably the main impetus for his relinquishing the judgment seat so that he can be more active in preaching. Then chapter 6 just gives us kind of a brief aftermath of his preaching in Zarahemla and shows us that it was effective, tells us that there was a lot of baptism and repentance going on, and kind of reconstitutes the church. It's a reorganization, if you will, of the church here at this time. And then he goes out, and chapter 7 is Alma going to the land of Gideon, or the Valley of Gideon, where a settlement has been established, and speaks to the members of the church there, and generally has good things to say to them. He's very impressed with how well they have stayed true to the faith. So he gives them some very nice, positive, uplifting doctrinal methods like that. But that is a brief recap of this section here. Did anyone else have anything they'd like to add for that before we start diving in?
Well, as part of this overview, I do think it's interesting to note the political dynamic here. Neil and I were talking over dinner today about how in King Benjamin's time, it appears that King Benjamin is the king, but he's really only just over that one city of Zarahemla, or as far as the text says, that's all we know. However, by this point in Alma 5, clearly other cities surrounding Zarahemla, such as Gideon and Ammonihah, are subservient in some way to Zarahemla. Zarahemla is starting to become this polity, this capital by over which other surrounding cities are connected in some sort of alliance.
Right, yeah, and that I think that is a...
developing of, if you will, the developing and expanding of it. We just kind of, every now and then we read these passages, oh, they multiplied, covered, whatever, which is probably hyperbole to some extent there. But we don't seem to notice that the extent of the Nephite state that's being described and how it changes over time. Like Jasmine mentioned, both during Benjamin's time and also during Mosiah's time, there has been really just one Nephite city we know of, and that's Zarahemla. One contributing factor to some of this expansion that we're seeing in the time of in the time of Alma's judgeship and then his high priestship, if you will, is the return of the people of Limhi, who we'll learn about. Well, by the time you're reading Alma 5 and 7, 5 through 7, you already know about them. But we're actually going to be studying, we're in the middle of studying them right now as we, in our Come Follow Me period here. But the people of Limhi and then the people of Alma, who are actually kind of a breakoff of the people of Limhi, they return to the land of Zarahemla, and we see some, they've been separated. They originally were part of the Nephites that came to Zarahemla, but they've been separated for a couple generations now. They've established somewhat of their own identities. And we don't know the extent to which this pushed some overcrowding in Zarahemla and forced the establishment of additional settlements. The fact that the one we're learning about here with Chapter 7 is called Gideon, which is named after the man that... Gideon was an officer for King Noah and subsequently King Limhi. So this is a group of people that are likely associated with some of those people who came up from the land of Nephi and reunited. So there's been some expansion and forced growth here.
Right, similar to how the anti-Nephi Lehis came and inherited the land of Jershon. They said, oh great, welcome, come join us, we'll put you in this city right here. There seems to be a similar thing happening with the people of Alma. When the people of Alma return to Zarahemla, they are welcomed with open arms, and it's possible that the city of Gideon ends up becoming their sanctuary city, you might say. Because, as you mentioned, it's named after Gideon, one of the officers in Limhi and Noah's court. But also, I wanted to point out that Alma seems to be going out on this missionary journey as part of a religious, certainly, but also a little bit of a political mission. In the ancient world, there wasn't a very clear concept of a separation of church and state, and we're seeing that instituted for the first time in the Book of Mormon. And as Zarahemla is expanding, and we now have these suburb cities, Gideon and Ammonihah and others, the battle that they're dealing with is constantly keeping a purity of religion and preventing the incursions of the outside culture. And you can see hints of this in King Benjamin's speech of trying to resist some of the cultural notions that the surrounding cultures have and their religious traditions. And that's the constant battle throughout the Book of Mormon. The Nephites keeping at bay the outside influences of the world and trying to keep the religion and worship of the one true God intact. And that's what kind of makes the Nephite polity distinct. And so as Zarahemla is expanding, it's possible they're seeing some rifts and tensions in the religious sphere. And when you see divisions in religion, it's certainly to follow that you might see some political shifts as well. And we see that later on in Alma. When the Zoramites split religiously, that's kind of what catalyzes the whole all of the war chapters later on in Alma. And so Alma is coming out on this mission trying to preach repentance to unify people religiously and to also unify the state, if you
will. Right, and in fact, it's not just later in Alma. In Alma 1 and 2 and 3, we had Nahor, who slew Gideon, actually, but was preaching a different religion. Actually go to Interpreter, they have a paper by Grant Gardner and Mark Wright that talks about Nephite apostasy, particularly examples like Nahor and the Zoramites and the like, illustrating how the cultural background of Mesoamerica can explain some of the forms of religious apostasy that we see. So this idea that there is outside influence coming in and impacting their religious, causing both religious and likely political fissures is very real. Nahor, the punishing of Nahor and his death actually incites a rebellion that leads to war, as described in Alma 2 and 3. So Alma's coming right off the heels of this exact kind of division that Jasmine's talking about. Absolutely, that is part of the context and part of what Alma is trying to prevent, he's trying to shore up the unity of the Nephite people, both in terms of religious unity leads to political unity, especially in the ancient world. And while they have begun to establish a certain amount of separation between church and state, religion and politics, this is the ancient world, and it's not really, it's not 2020, it's not 2020 America, where we've had over 200 years of tradition to establish a wider and wider divide between state and religion. This is an ancient world. This is a world where separation of church and state has never really happened, and so that... there's still very much a strong
connection. To illustrate that in a context more people might know something about, if you look at, say, early Christianity in its in the Greek world, you have all kinds of problems because the Christians refused to worship the various pagan deities, and that was very much associated with the civil practice of the area as well. So there wasn't any manner of separation between church and state. It was a matter of, this is the religion, but it's also part of the civil procedure. And if you don't do these things, you're not considered a loyal citizen of whatever nation.
Yeah, absolutely. And even the Jews in Roman times are experiencing similar things. The Roman Empire generally allowed for the practice generally allowed conquered peoples to continue the practice of their own religion. The difference was most conquered peoples and most peoples of that time and place, their religion was such that it could actually absorb. It could be absorbed into the Roman religion and vice versa. So they didn't usually resist worshiping Roman gods while also continuing to worship their own gods. But Judaism was different. Judaism had strict loyalty to Jehovah, to Yahweh, as it tends to be pronounced in more academic circles. But they had this notion of strict loyalty, and they eschewed the Roman gods. They refused to recognize Caesar as a god, they had a hard time even recognizing Caesar as a king because of their religious commitments. So it's not, we're not entirely unfamiliar with maybe a context where the freedom to technically the freedom to practice your own religion was there, but it still creates political and social tension with broader society when you have these diverse religious views that are exclusive in particular, which the Nephite religion was obviously an exclusivist religion.
Well, now that we've got a
let's get into chapter 5.
Now that we've got a great overview, let's dive in so that we don't run out of time. So he starts out in verse 1, explaining that he's in Zarahemla, but when he gets to verse 3, he talks about his authority. He starts his speech making sure that they know that he has the chops. He talks about how he draws his priesthood authority from his father, Alma, and he got his priesthood authority from King Noah's court, apparently. And he refers to how the people have come up out of the land of Nephi, and now they're in the land of Zarahemla after they were baptized. Neil, did you want to say something?
No, I'm good.
Oh, okay. And I find that interesting. And he talks about, he tells the story of his father's people. Alma was a priest in King Noah's court. He heard Abinadi speak. Once Abinadi spoke, Alma believed his words, and he fled from the court and starts gathering followers. He baptizes them in the waters of Mormon, and then when they return to Zarahemla, they've been freed from bondage because they are under bondage from the Lamanites for a while and are able to escape. And so Alma starts this speech by saying, remember the captivity of your fathers. You remember that they were in bondage, and then they escaped because the Lord delivered them. And then he starts this series of questions. But I think it's interesting he starts with the captivity of their fathers because he's in Zarahemla. And so he seems to be assuming that everyone has this common ground of being in captivity in the land of Nephi, when clearly that's not the case. If Zarahemla people are Nephites, Mulekites, and the people of Ammon. So I don't know. Is he talking to just his own people, or is he kind of just hyperbole appropriating that origin story for everyone, kind of like the pioneers?
The hand carved pioneers, yeah.
Of the church.
Yeah.
We kind of set that up without realizing it.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ed.
I don't know, but it's definitely a major theme, right? Because Alma chapter 5, Alma develops several really important polarities, if you will. There's captivity and freedom. There's God, or there's the devil and God. And there's a process by which you can leave captivity and come in to freedom, and a process by which you can leave the domination of the devil, wherein you're in the bondage of sin, and come into the effective presence of God, or under the influence of God, perhaps more precise. And the way that you do this, the way that you gain deliverance from spiritual bondage, comes when God sends messengers, and those to whom He sends them choose to receive them and hearken to them. Where is that? And here's Alma 5:10-11. And now I ask of you, on what conditions are they saved? Yea, what grounds have they to hope for salvation? What is the cause of their being loosed from the bands of death, yea, and also the chains of hell? Behold, I can tell you, did not my father Alma believe in the words which were delivered by the mouth of Abinadi, and was he not a holy prophet? Did he not speak the words of God, and my father Alma believed them? So, deliverance of the spiritual variety comes from believing the words of a true messenger, and, well, believing and obeying unto repentance.
That's a great point. Good insight there.
I like when he talks in verse 7 and 6, he's talking about the bands of death and the chains of hell. And Book of Mormon Central did a no-why on this, where they talked about how it seems like Alma's drawing from some biblical psalms, because some of the psalms talk about the bands of death, chains of hell. But it's interesting because Brant Gardner points out how chains would not have actually been a thing in Mesoamerica or in ancient America. They weren't a technology that was developed. And so Brant Gardner attributes it to Joseph Smith's translation that he might have just been drawing on King James language to say chains of hell. However, I do think it's interesting. I did a word search today, and the only person who uses the word chains, and it almost always occurs with the phrase chains of hell, is Alma. He uses it quite a few times in his sermons, and also Nephi talks about chains in Nephi's psalm. And David Larson argues how that is verbiage coming from the Psalms, but the phrase chains of hell actually never occurs in the King James Bible. So, I don't know, just interesting things.
Yeah, in fact, the Hebrew behind what David Larson's talking about, well, David Larson's the one who did the research for these no-wise on Book of Mormon Central. The verbiage there, the Hebrew verbiage, is a phrase that would maybe more commonly be translated something like bands, which we get here, bands of death, right? Bands or cords, something along those lines. But you have the word that's translated bands or cords of death, and you also have it bands or cords of hell. So it is possible that the word chains here is maybe coming from a translation context. And in fact, one thing that doesn't get mentioned in those no-wise is the fact that the expression chains of hell does show up in other 19th century contexts. And so, to me, this is actually a really interesting example of how the 19th century world might be influencing the exact verbiage of the translation, but that doesn't mean there isn't an authentic expression or ancient expression that can stand behind the text, because there is in fact an expression that can reasonably be translated as bands or cords of hell, or even chains of hell if that's how you opt to translate it, even though chains may not be the most accurate word. Maybe bands or cords or rope would be more accurate. Obviously conceptually chains are doing the same thing as that, and I think it kind of relates or goes back to the flaxen cord that Nephi talks about in, I want to say 2 Nephi 26, right? And he talks about, throughout the Book of Mormon, you have this idea of various things binding people down, death, hell, sin, things like that, in various ways. And I think it's all the same imagery and whether they're using the word chains, whether the original text would use actually the word chains or something else, conceptually this idea of being bound down by your sins, by wickedness, by death, by hell, this is all stuff that's very much a part of the underlying, some underlying Hebrew expressions in the Psalm, things like that.
Very interesting. So bands, cords, sounds like ropes would have been the more common binding instrument, but very interesting. And it's beautiful religious language, that this idea of conquering captivity. They literally fled captivity, but spiritually as well. They fled from the land of Nephi and rejoined their brethren in Zarahemla, where they could worship the way they chose and they could have salvation and be freed from the torments of hell. And this is where we get the phrase in verse 9 of singing redeeming love. What a gorgeous phrase. And I know that's one that's really common, but you can't underplay how beautiful the poetry in this section is. And he does that a few times, and it just kind of blows you away with these lovely little phrases that illustrate how powerful the gospel is, that when you are saved, you sing redeeming love.
Before we get too far off from the topic that Jasmine mentioned earlier, this interesting idea where Alma seems to be implying that the experience of his own fathers, his father and the people that followed him, is reflective and is kind of being applied to all the people at Zarahemla, even though we know that most of the people at Zarahemla probably were not descendants of anyone in Alma the Elder's group of people. They came as outsiders and were integrated into Zarahemla society, but he's appropriating their experience as the whole people's. It actually reminds me of an article that came out in 2017, but I recently reread for some research I was doing in Science Magazine. online on the Science Magazine website about the title. Let me see if I can find it really quickly. But it's about the idea that the notion of being a pure descendant or a pure having pure heritage is a myth. And it specifically it's talking mostly about European, and it says there's no such thing as a pure European or anyone else. But the reason this reminds me of it is because the author, Anne Gibbons, goes through several examples of different ethnic groups within Europe, say the Celts from, people in Scotland and Wales and Ireland who have this Celtic heritage and things like that. They trace their origins back to specific migrations and things like that. But genetic studies are actually revealing that their heritage is much more of a mishmash and a lot more complex than just this one migration of Celtic peoples once upon a time, a long time ago. And she gives several other examples of this where people's origins are a lot more complicated. This is what happens the world over, is ethnic groups identify culturally with a particular set of ancestors and kind of forget about all the other ones. And so you almost kind of see something like this happening with Alma, where he's oversimplifying the origins of the Nephite people in Zarahemla. And naturally, himself as one of the culturally elite, he is taking his own past, right, his own lineage history here, and making it and broadly applying it to all of the people, even though the people there in Zarahemla have a much more complex origin than just part of Alma's group, right?
Sure.
I wonder if one of the reasons why he feels like he can do that is because when the people of Alma arrived in the land, they read each other's records as part of kind of a joining together of the peoples.
Oh, yeah, that's
so because it raises the question to me whether part of becoming united is learning each other's history so that we have a basis of shared understanding and shared stories.
Oh, yeah.
Because that, I think, is a lot of what really unites a people. You have to, in order to have a united people, you have to build a united culture. And a story of shared stories is a good way to begin that process.
Absolutely. I think that's true. And for those who Hales is referring to at the end of the Book of Mosiah, when it talks about these people coming into the land of Zarahemla, they open the records and Mosiah has them read to the people. And I think that absolutely, again, that ties back to our conversation about pioneers and how really whether you are a descendant of pioneers or you're a convert to the church or you grew up outside the U.S. and so maybe you have, you're not a convert and you have several ancestors who have been in the church, but you're not really a descendant of the American pioneers, right? Whether that's you or not, these are our common shared stories, and this is this gives us a common cultural and religious heritage to share these stories and to tell these stories and to draw meaning and connection from these stories, right? It's the same kind of thing, I think.
And what I think is very interesting about this speech is that it's done in a rhetorical way that I've never seen anywhere else, where starting in verse 5, basically until the end of the chapter, Alma gives an entire sermon, almost entirely consisting of questions. He rarely makes an assertive statement or declares anything. Instead, he asks a bunch of rhetorical questions. Do you remember the captivity of your fathers? If so, did you remember that the Lord delivered them? If so, have you received a mighty change in your heart? Have you received God's image in your heart? He goes on and on and on with these questions. And I'm not exactly sure what he's trying to do with it, but I find it fascinating that he's just using questions as a rhetorical device to deliver a really powerful sermon. And I know John W. Welch has counted these, and he counts 50 questions in total. And he attributes it to the Jubilee. He believes that this is the Jubilee year that Alma is, or is the last sabbatical year before the Jubilee that Alma is giving this sermon on. And he theorizes that maybe the occasion is Nephiha taking over the judgment seat, that on this occasion Alma is now giving kind of a, maybe like a King Benjamin type farewell speech, and this is what he's doing for it, to prepare them for the on the sabbatical year, he's preparing them for the Jubilee, in which they would renew their covenants again, after it's been about 50 years since King Benjamin's speech and that covenant renewal ceremony. John W. Welch suggests that maybe there's a similar thing going on here, and these questions is a similar thing that maybe ancient Israelites would have done with covenant renewal. He kind of compares it to a temple recommend interview. You know, let's measure yourself up. Are you doing this? Do you think you're doing this? Can you stand before God with a clean heart? Has his image been graven in your countenance? And helping them measure up and establish their standing before the Lord, prepare for a Jubilee year. So that's pretty interesting.
I think you make a really good point with the questions, because I think where he's going with it is essentially to prepare them for the judgment. In Alma 5:18, we have, "Or otherwise, can you imagine yourselves brought before the tribunal of God with your souls filled with guilt and remorse, having a remembrance of all your guilt, yea, a perfect remembrance of all your wickedness, yea, a remembrance that ye have set at defiance the commandments of God?" So he's asking them questions that lead them to examine themselves and experience perhaps a little foretaste of what they will experience at the judgment as they review their souls, if you will. And he makes this interesting point, which is that you'll have a perfect remembrance of all your wickedness. And this is a frequent concept in the Book of Mormon teachings on judgment. You will be judged, in a sense, through your own recollections. And at that time, you won't be able to forget a bit of it. So you ought to make sure that your recollections include your repentance, because if it doesn't, then you will look back on the whole thing with remorse and guilt. And if we instead consider ourselves now, find out and ask ourselves whether we have been sufficiently humble in all these things, we have the opportunity to repent now so that we will be able to face the judgment bar with joy then.
Absolutely. I think while we're on the subject here, it might be worth just mentioning, Jasmine talked about some of John W. Welch's insights here on Alma 5. He does have a recent book out that's co-authored with Ed J. Pinneker called Experiencing a Mighty Change of Heart, that is all about Alma 5 and his discourse here. It's not a long book. It's under 150 pages. So if you're interested in really digging into some of these kinds of insights, that might be something worth checking out. But if you don't want to dig in quite that deep, there is a know why on this idea from Book of Mormon Central on this idea of the 50 questions and fleshing out some of what John W. Welch said here.
But going back to verse 16, this is one of the famous scriptures that we all remember. "I would ask of you, my brethren of the church, have you spiritually been born of God? Have you received his image in your countenances? And have you experienced this mighty change in your hearts?" And this is just beautiful. It doesn't take a biblical scholar or a Book of Mormon scholar to appreciate how beautiful and inspiring and moving this idea is of being changed in our hearts to receive God's image in our countenance. But there also is interesting ancient precedence to this, the idea of engraving one's image upon one's countenance. And I don't know if, Neil, you want to maybe talk about this for a minute.
Sure. It's actually something that I mentioned the paper by Brant Gardner and Mark Wright, the Cultural Context of Nephite Apostasy in the Interpreter from the Interpreter Foundation. They actually highlight this, and then there's a no-why from Book of Mormon Central as well that draws on this insight. But in verse, after first, you know, asking if they've experienced this change of heart and received the image of God on their countenances, in verse 19, he specifically asks, "Can you look up having the image of God engraven on your countenance?" And Mark Wright and Brant Gardner talk about how in ancient Mesoamerica, they would literally have engraven masks of the image of a deity. And they would even describe these. There was a common phrase in Mayan that would where they would describe the mask as literally being the Uba'il, or the holy image of deity X, right? Whatever the deity's name was in that case. And they would have these graven masks, and they would wear them in and be in full costume and have these elaborate ceremonies where they were believed to where they believed they were literally taking on the image and becoming in a certain sense this deity during these rituals. And Mark Wright and Brant Gardner talk about how kind of against this background and this context, Alma's question about receiving and engraving and then engraving God's image upon one's own countenance is kind of a dig at this practice, if you will, meant to kind of reorient the people back to the true God, whose mm-hmm. image they should be seeking to have spiritually engraven on their countenance, rather than all of these false gods, if you will.
And if I remember,
and the best part is you don't even need a mask for it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
If I remember correctly, these deity masks weren't worn by everyone, just people of elite status, right, during certain ceremonial or festival occasions. And so the idea that we all can receive God's image in our countenance is kind of a democratizing of having access to God and access to deity.
Yeah, absolutely. Most practices that scholars will talk about in the ancient world are practices that were basically limited to the social elite. So one of the radical things we see in the Book of Mormon starting with Nephi. Nephi does some of this as well, but absolutely with King Benjamin and onward, is these practices that are usually reserved for the social elite are being democratized and extended to all of the Nephite people. And in a lot of different ways. And that does kind of seem to be the undercurrent here, is everyone is being invited to have the image of God, the true God, engraven on their countenance. It's not just the king or other social elites and what.
And that very much fits in with what Alma 5:54 says, "Yea, will you persist in supposing that you're better one than another?"
Yeah,
that's a great thing.
This whole democratization is very much a key feature of Nephite society that you don't find as much in other parts of the ancient world. It's something that was fairly unique to them, as these things go.
And I'd like to point out the concept that Alma expounds upon with being born of God. And this is a pretty Christian-sounding concept, the idea, it's something we see in the Gospel of John with Nicodemus about how are we reborn and being born of God. But Alma brings it up here, and as I was pondering this and studying it this week, I kind of talked back and forth with Neil a little bit, and he has done some work on kingship in King Benjamin's speech and how in ancient America there would be, at a coronation of a new king, there would be ceremonies to demonstrate how the king is the mother of the gods, and how he kind of ceremoniously gives birth to these gods. And here again, we kind of see a little bit of a democratization. King Benjamin emphasizes how he is not divine, but there will be a king who will be divine, and he will be so divine that he will bleed from every pore, and his mother will be called Mary. And he's talking about the Messiah and the king. And so, it's almost interesting how now that Alma's preaching, he's talking about how Jesus Christ will give birth to us through salvation, and almost saying that he is taking the role of king and we are taking the role of deity in that sense. The Messiah, through his sacrifice, gives birth spiritually to us, which means that we can become as deity. We can have the image of deity engraven on our countenances and become like the gods. And that is a pretty revolutionary and remarkable thing for the ancient world and even for us today. And I think it's beautiful, the idea that if we repent and obey, we can become like God and have his image upon us always, engraven in our hands, engraven in our face, and part of everything we do.
The image of engraving is also interesting because they talk about, they ask the question, have we had a mighty change of heart? And I would submit that one of the ways in which we need to have our hearts changed is to have the principles of the gospel written in our hearts so that out of that changed heart come forth and flow freely the actions which the gospel leads to, actions of service, acts of faith, acts of kindness of every sort, type, and description.
And I know we're running out of time, so we probably need to move on, but the entire chapter continues on, building upon each thought. He has a very cohesive logic, which he builds upon one thing on another, and with all of these beautiful questions to help people understand their standing before God. And definitely worth digging in deep. I could spend hours talking about Alma 5. But since we only have a few more questions, unless anyone has final thoughts on Alma 5. Okay, let's move on to Alma 6, really briefly. This one's super short, 8 verses long. It's basically the to-be-continued, what-you-missed-last-time interlude between Alma 5 and 7, because Alma 5 is his speech in Zarahemla, Alma 7 is his speech in Gideon. And it explains that Alma then stopped preaching. He ordained priests and established a church, reestablished a church in Zarahemla, which is an important point. And then moves on to Gideon. Any thoughts we want to talk about with this chapter?
Other than noting, yeah, this is kind of like aftermath of the speech there. And I know this is going to sound maybe a little boring, but it's short chapters like this that give us little clues to the administrative nature of the Nephite church and how things functioned. And I know John W. Welch has talked about how there's actually a lot of value in this because when you look at the way the early church, the early Restoration Church in 1830 and onward functioned, it seems that they drew a lot of their administrative organizational principles, administrative principles, right out of chapters like this in the Book of Mormon. So there's some value here. This was a book that was written for the latter days, and so maybe even Mormons kind of thinking, like, why should I include this really boring stuff? But he maybe was inspired to do that precisely so that we could have some of these instructions while we as we establish the church here in the modern latter days. With that, maybe we dive into Alma 7, his sermon in Gideon. There's a little more here to talk about than there was in Alma 6. Maybe not as much to talk about as there was in Alma 5. But
yes, compared to the 62 verses in Alma 5, Alma 7 is 27 verses, and we assume that this is direct quotation from Alma, but who knows, maybe a Mormon abridged this speech. We don't know, but he certainly is happy to be in Gideon, because the people of Gideon, unlike the people in Zarahemla, seem to have a greater understanding of the faith and are loyal and believers of the covenant, and they are strong. And Alma expresses as much about how relieved he is to finally be talking to people who actually get it. And it's lovely. It's a breath of fresh air for Alma and a breath of fresh air for us, because we get teachings in Alma 7 that we don't get elsewhere, and I think it's because of these people who have proven themselves faithful of receiving further light and knowledge. And because we're short on time, I'm just going to dive right into the middle where it talks about Jesus Christ, where he prophesies of Christ. And he says that he knows this because of the Spirit, that the Spirit said unto him and prophesied these things. And so this is a really interesting situation where we don't necessarily see a line of tradition where Alma's drawing this from, but direct revelation from God about the nature of Jesus Christ's mission and his suffering and his origin. He shall be born of Mary at Jerusalem, and she will be a virgin and a chosen vessel. And we get some of this elsewhere in the Book of Mormon, but when he talks about repentance and how we need to repent because Jesus Christ will suffer pains and afflictions and temptations of every kind, that the word might be fulfilled, that he will take upon him the pains and the sicknesses of his people. Now, when he says the pains and sicknesses, fulfilling the word, it's probably an allusion to Isaiah 53, where he talks about that he will be despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. He'll take upon us our sorrows. But he's clearly expounding here as well.
And I just wanted to note that the expression that Alma uses There's a paper by Tom Wayment in the Journal of the Book of Mormon Studies. I don't remember the exact year off the top of my head, but he actually goes through and shows that the expression that Alma uses here is probably an alternative translation of Alma 53. It doesn't seem like exact verbiage if you're looking at the King James, but he argues that based on the Hebrew verbiage there, that it actually is a translation of a phrase from Alma 53.
Let's read those three verses, because those are just some of the best, right?
All right, go right ahead.
And he shall go forth, suffering pains and afflictions and temptations of every kind, and this that the word might be fulfilled, which saith, he will take upon him the pains and the sicknesses of his people. And he will take upon him death, that he may loose the bands of death which bind his people. And he will take upon him their infirmities, that his bowels may be filled with mercy according to the flesh, that he may know according to the flesh how to succor his people according to their infirmities. Now the Spirit knoweth all things. Nevertheless, the Son of God suffereth according to the flesh, that he might take upon him the sins of his people, that he might blot out their transgressions according to the power of his deliverance. And now, behold, this is the testimony which is in me. So there's those.
Really beautiful stuff. And one thing that I want to know is that here in Alma 7, we have a little bit of a different take on our traditional interpretation of Isaiah 53, where we often talk about him taking upon us, he will suffer and he will be acquainted with grief, and by his stripes we are healed. We tend to think about it as him taking on suffering as expiation or as atonement for sin. But here, in at least in verse 11, Alma seems to be talking about the Savior taking upon him suffering in order to empathize with us, in order to succor us. So that he will know how to do it. And it even explains in verse 13 how the Spirit knoweth all things. And by extension, God would know all things. Jesus Christ could know all things if he wanted to. If he came to earth and just wanted to know what it was like to suffer, he could access that knowledge if he wanted to. But he chose to suffer because he wanted to feel. He wanted to have that knowledge experientially, not just theoretically, so that he could succor us, run to us for aid, and to heal us of our wounds and suffering.
Absolutely. I've never actually made this connection before, and I've just barely thought about it, but I wonder how much of this is rooted in Alma's own conversion experience. That we get a little bit of the story in Mosiah 27, but we get the full story in Alma 36. But in particular, right at the end of verse 13, it actually does talk more in familiar atonement and reconciliation language. But he talks about how he suffereth according to the flesh, that he might take upon the sins of his people, that he might blot out their transgressions according to the power of his deliverance. And now, behold, this is the testimony which is in me. To me, that sounds very... I mean, Alma's visceral experience that he describes in Alma 36 is all about having sin and transgression blotted out, being delivered, literally, physically delivered from, I don't know what to call it. A comatose state, really.
Not just the coma. It was more or less the sufferings that one would experience post-mortally,
right,
from a life of willful, horrible sin.
Right. Yeah. He has literally experienced this aspect of the atonement in a very tangible way. Probably a more tangible way than most other people will or have experienced in mortality. And that last phrase, this is the testimony which is in me, just really struck me as, you know what, he's talking about his own direct experience here. This is what Alma knows because he's lived it, really.
And consider the effect that it had on him, right? And also on the sons of Mosiah. It describes them elsewhere as... And by saying, for they were the very vilest of sinners.
Right, yeah.
And the consequence of their experience, and if you will, their brush with hell, was that they could not suffer, or that any living soul should face eternal torment. Mm-hmm. Like the very thought that any soul should face endless torment did fill them with inexpressible horror. So it really did have a changing effect on them, in that it gave them a passionate desire to teach the gospel to help others avoid the fate that they mutually had a brush with. And I wonder if you're not right, Neil, that there's essentially a parallel with what Christ experienced and his desire to bless and heal us spiritually. I think that's an interesting insight.
Absolutely. In fact, looking at verse 14 right after it, the first line, you know, the next thing he says is, "Now I say unto you that ye must repent and be born again. For the Spirit saith, if ye are not born again, ye cannot inherit the kingdom of heaven." And this is literally, again, this is Alma's experience, right? That he wakes up and he experiences this being born of God, repenting and being born again, kind of spirit. So, I can't believe I've never noticed that before, but I see it just staring me in the face right now.
Well, since we're just about out of time, let's just round off with final thoughts on Alma 5 through 7. I just want to, my final thought will be Alma 7, verse 25. It talks about Alma's giving basically an apostolic blessing to the people, saying, "Thank you for your righteousness. I bless you forever. And may you sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and may your garments be spotless even as their garments are spotless." And that is a lovely promise of redemption for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who were basically almost deities. They were so revered prophets that they were unattainably righteous. And for us, we can have the hope of having our garments as spotless as theirs if we obey.
Any final thoughts, Hale?
I suppose, kind of channeling Alma 5, choose God, choose liberty, choose to be clean, choose the peace of conscience, which surpasses all understanding.
Excellent. Beautiful. Honestly, my last comment is probably as good of a final thought as I can come up with. So I think with that, we will wrap up our discussion. This has been the Interpreter Show, sponsored by Cruise Lady. I am Neil Rapley. I'm joined here in studio by Jasmine Rapley and